Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I am joined by Ulash Inja, author of the recently published Colonial Capitalism and the Dilemmas of Liberalism. Colonial Capitalism was published by Oxford University Press in 2018. Ulash takes up the complex question or analysis of the intersection of economics and politics, or rather, the development of Western capitalism and the development of modern liberalism, especially in context of Great Britain and its imperial experience. This is a fascinating analysis, multifaceted and extremely well-researched and assessed, but I will let Ulash get into more of the details of his book and thesis as we proceed. First, I would like to introduce Ulash Inja and ask him to tell us a bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hello, Ulash.
Hello, Lily. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I set out to study political science with the intention of joining the Foreign Service, but I got beguiled by the siren calls of academia as soon as I started studying political science, branched out of sociology, got back into political science at the level of the PhD, and completed my studies at Cornell. To be perfectly honest, I did not intend to study the British Empire, political economy, or history of political thought when I joined Cornell.
Of course not.
No, of course not. My intention was to continue my studies into Frankfurt School and critical theory, in particular the work of Walter Benjamin. And this project came out from the sort of fortuitous coincidence, as if coincidences were non-fortuitous, of reading three things at once. I was reading Benjamin, Locke, and Silvia Federici around the same week. And then I was struck by the uncanny resonance between certain passages in the Second Treatise and some of the history of primitive accumulation that Silvia Federici outlines in her book. And then I noticed that something was going on. And one of the sparks behind this project was a speech by a former World Bank president, John Wolfensohn, who also incidentally the co-author of Amartya Sen, about development and development knowledge being global commons, but best cultivated and disseminated by a set of specialized agents and institutions, which was, as I said, uncannily resonant with Locke's pronouncements about the world being, the earth being the common inheritance of mankind, but it being given in particular to the industrious and the rational. So this interplay between the universal and the particular, if you will. And I noticed in short order that this question could not be studied independent of the history of capitalism. So this was basically the rabbit that I chased down the hole. I was praying that I wouldn't have to write about this, but you know, I did go down the rabbit hole, and out of that hole, this book has emerged. And in the course of reading more about Locke, and Locke is a gift that keeps giving when it comes to histories of colonialism and political thought, I noticed that the existing literature was characterized by a striking dearth of attention to matters of political economy and then history of capitalism, with a few exceptions, of course. And that was the principal animus, if you will, that drove me to dig deeper into the history of capitalism in the imperial context. And I should be able to tell a few that little more about the framing of colonial capitalism in a bit, but that was in a, to return to the main intervention of the book. That was the main animus materialize or rematerialize the relationship between political theory and empire, and more specifically liberalism and empire, by demonstrating how this relationship has been structurally mediated by capitalism. But accounting for that mediation requires a self-conscious theory of capitalism and not just a descriptive history. And that is where I turn to histories of, and then theories of, primitive accumulation of capital, especially in the colonial context, to, if you will, reconstruct and theorize the imperial contexts in which historical texts, and particular texts associated with liberalism, have been situated. So, and in the course of this this research, I retrospectively realized that I was basically writing about the three conceptual hinges of property, exchange, and labor that connected the history of liberalism as a political language and history of capitalism as a socioeconomic formation that has been global and colonial in scope since its inception.
Yeah, and you do a really great job of laying out that sort of three components, and you have them in context of three different continental spaces that you discuss in the book as well. But I'd love for you to sort of delve into the thesis of the book, which, as you sort of talk through it in the introduction, you emphasize the brutality of the establishment of capitalism in context also of the sort of empirical reach of the British state. And at the same time, the emphasis on the freedom of the newly established liberal state. And this duality is very much in tension in your unpacking of these ideas and the systems that are growing and flourishing during this period. Can you explain a bit about this broad thesis that you're undertaking, particularly with the emphasis on understanding empire, capitalism, and liberal thought?
So the more specific intervention of the book as it concerns liberalism and empire, and this is a growing, if somewhat recently sort of, it's a growing literature that has somehow, that has somewhat recently plateaued or slowed down, but nonetheless, it is kind of a small cottage industry of its own. So the principal intervention is in that field, and it offers a different account of British imperial ideology and the, in particular, liberal imperialism of Britain. And it argues that what really mattered, if you will, for the construction of a liberal self-image for the British Empire as the Empire of Liberty was the work of liberal intellectuals of empire, or middle-class liberal intellectuals of empire like Locke, Burke, and Wakefield, who both expressed and navigated this contradiction between an increasingly liberal conception and imagination of commercial relations in Britain, or commercial capitalist relations in Britain, and the coercive extra-economic and non-market forms of transformation and modalities of labor control and property relations that typify the British Empire as a whole. So it's this contradiction, if you will, between the liberal self-image of capitalism and its illiberal genealogy, which has been acknowledged by recent histories of new capitalism or new histories of capitalism. So that's the puzzle, if you will, that the book sets out. And this is not a new puzzle, obviously. You know, the tension between the illiberalism of empire and its liberal mission has been explored by many political theorists, anthropologists, postcolonial theorists, and so on and so forth. But those histories, as I mentioned in the book, have been mostly dematerialized. And then this is, I think, a function of the cultural and linguistic turns that have stamped postcolonial theory and intellectual history over the past 30 years or so, that have also marked the engagement with liberalism and empire. So what I do in the book is to shift the focus from preoccupation with the representations and identities of the colonizer and the colonized, which is usually framed in the existing literature as a matter of universals, you know, the universal claims of liberalism and the cultural particularities of the colonized. So shifting the focus from that preoccupation of politics of universalism to the problem of the illiberalism of capitalism, that is, that from a preoccupation with who the colonized are to what the colonizers do as itself a colonial anomaly, if you will, or an aberration that had to be justified at the bar of liberal political theory or increasingly liberal understanding of Britain's empire, Britain's polity. So the book argues that the maintenance of the liberal self-image of the British Empire, which purportedly distinguished it from, for instance, the agrarian absolutism of France or the feudal imperialism of Spain, that is, its commercial, Pacific, free, you know, what David Armitage called commercial, Protestant, maritime, and free character. I argue that this image, this construction and maintenance of this image owed a great deal to the work of middle class or medium level intellectuals like Locke, Burke, and Wakefield, who were actively involved in the affairs of the empire, who both acknowledged the problem of illiberality, however obliquely, but at the same time tried to navigate this problem, this ideological problem, by casting this illiberality as either incidental to or deviation from the essentially liberal image of the British Empire. So, you know, so the particularly revealing example of this is my discussion of Burke's castigation of the East India Company Corps, who he did not refrain from characterizing as the dregs of humanity and so on and so forth, but at the same time held that these agents of the company were about a bunch of corrupt and unruly, ungovernable agents at the frontiers, and that had nothing to do with the commercial essence, if you will, of the British Empire, and that a truly commercial relationship could be established between Britain and its conquered Indian provinces. So here we have an acknowledgement of the problem, and not its denial, but its disavowal through elaborate narratives and discursive theoretical innovations and maneuvers that distantiate, that cordon off, if you will, the essence, the commercial liberal essence of British commercial capitalism from the bondage, from the extraction, from the rapacious exploitation through which land and labor were incorporated into circuits of British capital. So that's the more, if you will, specific intervention of the book in the field of political theory, and in particular of liberal theory in the context of empire.
And you sort of sketch out the sort of wall, as you, I think, sort of acknowledge it, between the liberal thought, rule of law, representative government, ethical pluralism, and subjective rights that are sort of the hallmarks of liberalism. And then on the opposite side, what was going on with regard to the practices of domination, foreign rule, you know, sort of abject power, coercion, exclusion and disenfranchisement, that these are the tensions that, as you sort of talk about in terms of the thinkers, Locke, Burke, and Wakefield, are kind of massaging the understanding of those of this sort of distinction. But you also note that Smith, Adam Smith, and Hume are in a somewhat different camp with regard to their thinking and their approach to some of these tensions. Can you speak to that a bit?
Maybe I could speak about that towards the end of our talk, because sure. That is part of the second project. Actually, this is not a bad moment to maybe widen the aperture and speak a little more about the broader framing of the project, so the theoretical framework.
Absolutely.
Through which I try to offer a new, not just a new reading of Locke, Burke, and Wakefield, but more generally, what is kind of the aspiration or the vanishing point of this book and the current book that I'm working on, that is a kind of a new social history of political thought that is imperial in scope. Now, when confronted by most historians and intellectual historians that whether my reading of Locke, Burke, and Wakefield is true to their intentions and the linguistic context in which they wrote, my answer is usually that this book is not about Locke, Burke, or Wakefield. This is about the relationship between liberalism, capitalism, and empire, and the contradictory and constitutive relationship between the three. So to put it somewhat bluntly, and then aesthetically perhaps, it is not my contention that liberalism existed independent or prior to capitalism, and you know, it came into conflict with the violent history of capitalism as an exogenous entity. But as a political language, it developed in and through the history of capitalism. So in other words, I don't examine liberalism just as a political language, but also as an ideology of capitalism. And the way I theorize and formulate this is that primitive accumulation as this coercive, non-economic or extra-economic coercive process that institutes the background conditions of capitalism, also gives rise to the institutional mainstays of liberalism, that is private property, market exchange, and free labor, by obliterating or subordinating alternative forms or contending forms of organizing property exchange and work. Now, the point to emphasize, and this is something that I will come back to when I talk about Hume and Smith, that these three institutions, that is private property, market exchange, and free labor, are in no way the only or even the primary forms of organizing the accumulation of capital as a planetary system, because as you know, has been more recently written examined, capitalism, from its dawn to our present moment, has always been a variegated totality, always been racialized, always been gendered. It's been a heterogeneous totality of social and legal forms, which proceeds by, so not so much a universalization of a particular of a unique form or a singular form, but through sort of globalization and striation of multiple forms. But this liberal conception of capitalism that sees it as a essentially market formation that is based on juridical equality and contractual freedom. I call these the primal norms of liberalism. The juridical equality and contractual freedom. This rests on isolating these three forms of private property, market exchange, and free legally free labor, and the principles of freedom and equality, market freedoms and equalities that they represent, as the defining feature of capitalism, while relegating other modes of appropriating resources or controlling labor, especially when they are hyper-exploitative or overtly violent and coercive, as anomalies or aberrations that can be realigned and ought to be realigned by the logic, the logic of private property and market freedoms. So, this is basically the broader framing of this contradiction between liberalism and capitalism. You know, but there's also co-constitution between these two, in the sense that the, as I said, the again, to put it bluntly, liberal norms of market freedoms, there's a contractual freedom and juridical equality, have their conditions of possibility in the social transformations associated with the rise of capitalism. But at the same time, this essentially liberal conception of capitalism, or put in terms of ideology critique, the necessary misrecognition of capitalism as an essentially liberal market formation is also what authorizes renewed waves or acts of primitive accumulation. And so in the imperial context, it manifests itself as the self-assurance of the political and intellectual classes of Britain that their empire is liberal at heart. It's commercial, it's maritime, and it's not like the Spanish or the French or the Dutch, notwithstanding, you know, engagement in slave trade or settler colonialism or commercial extortion in the Indian Ocean and so on and so forth. So there is, in this sense, a kind of a mutual or reciprocal relationship or co-constitutive, although albeit contradictory, relationship between liberalism and capitalism. And it is this contradiction that stands in need of disavowal or navigation, negotiation, or containment. And this is where the middle-class intellectuals of empire like Locke, Burke, and Wakefield come into the picture.
And in this context, because you do sort of discuss a lot the juridical equality and contractual freedom as the linchpins, as you say, of the sort of understanding that's growing during this time. Can you explain a bit what those terms mean in context?
Uh-huh. That's a great question. Thank you. Well, obviously, this is a construct, right? So it's not that Locke, Burke, and Wakefield go about openly or expressing their position in formulaic terms. Well, we're in favor of juridical equality and contractual freedom. But these norms, these primal norms, although they cannot be observed as such, or eo nomine in any particular historical text, they are recognizable in the different political languages in which these three figures wrote. I mean, Locke wrote in the language of natural jurisprudence, for instance. And one can discern the commitment to these norms in his natural jurisprudential language. Likewise, although Burke moved to the language of ancient constitutionalism, when you look at his political economic writings, you likewise see an endorsement of juridical equality and contractual freedom as the defining feature of the British economy and then the economic organization. And finally, Wakefield, he himself is a Benthamite, a philosophical radical, and a positivist. So in that sense, is quite different from the other two. But nonetheless, his political economy likewise betrays that foundational commitment to these norms. So in other words, the reason I call them the primal norms is because they animate and they structure the more historically specific mode of argumentation couched in these diverse languages, but nonetheless is recognizable across these different contexts and political languages. And I think there's a reason why that is the case, because all these three thinkers are writing about commercial society. A commercial society is one in which the basic mode of sociality, if you will, the glue or the building block of sociality itself, is superficial yet reiterated relations of exchange between property holders. So in other words, yes.
Go ahead.
And in that sense, these two principles are foundational principles of commercial society as a social formation. And then this is where we resort to social theory, really, and step away from intellectual history as such. And that provides a guiding thread for looking for investigating and identifying, delineating the specific expressions of these foundational principles of a commercial capitalist economy.
And that was what I wanted to sort of get at a little bit next in terms of the title of your book, and really a lot about the discussion within the book is this concept of colonial capitalism. And you talk, and you just sort of mentioned the critical social theory and the colonial political economy. We also have this, you know, broad political theorists. So can you position and explain colonial capitalism in context of sort of this multifaceted sort of understanding?
Sure. So in a sense, in a recent talk, I think it was in a talk, Robin Kelly said that racial capitalism is actually a tautology, that there's never been a non-racial capitalism, that it's not a type of capitalism. The same can be said of colonial capitalism. I mean, I chose the term colonial capitalism to emphasize, to decenter, if you will, histories of capitalism away from Europe and to draw attention to the global inceptions and colonial genealogies of this, of the social formation. But historically, capitalism has been global and colonial or imperial in its constitution, and both in historical terms, in the sense that the conditions of capital accumulation in Europe even resided beyond the continent. So it was, the capitalism was born as a global network, an archipelago of accumulation, rather than a social system or socioeconomic system that was first born in Europe and then exported to the rest of the world. So, for instance, the role of the colonies in the history of capitalism was not simply one of resource extraction. And, you know, recent, some of the other more influential, if you will, mainstream work like Ken Pomeranz's Great Divergence has credited colonialism with enabling Europeans to overcome resource bottlenecks. But I think there's more at stake, because colonial spaces were also spaces of experimentation with new forms of labor control and productivity and efficiency, new forms of appropriation of natural resources, and new forms of exchange that in certain respects were too brutal to be experimented with even in Europe. And part of it has to do with, as I said, the imperial constitution of the global order within which capitalism was born, which positioned colonies beyond the so-called law of nations or the jus publicum europaeum, that delimited the use of coercion or force of violence in matters of appropriation, distribution, and exploitation. So in that sense, formation of a world market, the experimentation with organized labor, and forms of pure market exchange, a commercial exchange that is unmoored from other forms of social other social obligations or embeddedness, were made possible by this exceptional, if you will, for the lack of a better term, I don't like this term, but the exceptional status of the colonies as zones of legal indeterminacy, if you will. So in that sense, the incorporation of the Indian Ocean through militarized trading, settler colonialism in America, slavery in the Caribbean, later forms of indenture, later forms of settler colonialism in Australia and New Zealand, and the attendant forms of settler capitalism. These are all episodes, if you will, constitutive episode or constituent moments of the birth of or the rise of capitalism as a global system. In that sense, I emphasize the colonial dimension, both to sort of underscore this imperial constitution, but also because the coercion that posed an ideological problem for the liberal self-image of capitalism, especially as expressed in British political economy, that unfolded more openly, more brazenly, more blatantly in the colonies. Of course, there was primitive accumulation in the British Isles. There was enclosures, highland clearances, vagrancy laws, all the stuff that Marx and Marxian historians have written about. But in England, there was a common law in and through which these such coercion could be deemed illegal or against the law of the land, could be resisted, negotiated, and so on and so forth. but colonies were placed beyond these legal strictures, and therefore the violence of primitive accumulation unfolded much more openly. So you have the Statute of Artificers and Poor Laws in Britain. You have the Slave Code in Barbados. So and that is the reason why I've chosen to stick with the term colonial capitalism, notwithstanding the fact that capitalism, it is a certain redundancy and tautology.
And so you started to get into the sort of particular areas that you explore this discussion, this sort of entangled history of liberalism, capitalism, and empire at the three critical moments. And you talk about the, you know, sort of the land appropriation in the Americas, the East India Company, and what went on in India, and then the imperial labor in Australasia. Can you talk a little bit about these three sort of, I don't want to say case studies, but the examples that you bring out at these critical moments in these different contents, where you have, you know, sort of this private property, market exchange, free labor going on within the sort of rising capitalism?
So the property exchange labor triad, and that triad is constant in all three chapters, but one looks at the flashpoint of debate as it when it comes to the apprehension, theorization, and justification of colonial capitalism. One sees the particular concentration of attention, if you will, on one of these nodes of the triad in each of these points. So in the 17th century, when one turns to 17th century European debates on property, it is not surprising that the debate is on property, because the contact with the New World and the contending claims to American land is the all-consuming preoccupation of the sovereign fiscal military states, or the territorial fiscal military states in Europe, and the merchant capital that is allied with them. So you see an intensification of debate around the question of original title, or radical title, and original appropriation. What is the original appropriation? What is the basis of legitimate property? How do we make non-property into property? And there we see Locke intervening into this debate. So now obviously, Locke's colonial investment in English colonialism, both personal and professional, has been documented. But what the chapter does is to show how Locke's theory of private property not only strives to invalidate contending European and Native American claims to landed property in America, but it does so through a particularly capitalist optic, or with a capitalist motive, because it is the labor theory of value that Locke articulates, and in particular weaves around his notion of money that is decisive for Locke's adjudication of what is common and what is property. So the argument there is, Locke argues that land in America is common. There's no property because there is no money, and that's kind of a departure from the labor centric theories or the interpretations of this argument. That later on becomes a very good, potent ideological weapon in the armature of settler colonialism way after Locke has articulated this thesis. In the 18th century, by the 18th century, the justification of land appropriation is pretty much laid to rest. That Lockean argument carries the day. The new flashpoint there becomes the problem of trade, and that has to do with the fact that, again, the European incursion into the Indian Ocean accelerates in this period through militarized trading of the joint stock companies, and in particular the British ascendancy in the subcontinent. the political and intellectual preoccupation becomes the nature of Britain's trade with the East. And there we find Burke's arguments about the true nature, the exact nature of Britain's commercial relationship to India, and the defense of the imperial presence, Britain's imperial presence of India. Burke is by no means an anti-imperialist like Smith and Hume have been credited as. And his adherence to the image of, or the notion of Britain as an essential commercial nation that doesn't do imperialism. So it's, again, as Dean Moorfield once felicitously put it, an attempt to imagine an empire without imperialism, if you will. And finally, when we turn to the 19th century, settlement of Australia and New Zealand, we find the debate again. This is not just about Wakefield or Burke or Locke. The debate there rages around what to do with the England's the Britain's poor that have returned from fighting Napoleon and found themselves in the midst of a massive slump, economic slump, and become a political problem. You know, so the social question, if you will. Threatens the British political order, and then the question of what to do with this excess labor. So, I mean, this is where you have Malthus. This is where you have the danger of the overpopulation and worker class militancy, and so on and so forth. And that's when emigration becomes a solution, a safety valve. And that coincides with the abolition of slavery in the British Isles, which further intensifies the problem of labor. And Wakefield's the theory of systematic colonization provides an answer to both of these problems. That is, how to redress the imbalance of labor across the British Empire by funneling, if you will, the excess labor in Britain into the colonies that are now suffering from a dearth of labor, but doing so requires the intervention, the legal and administrative intervention of the British state to maintain the emigrants dispossessed, to prevent them from turning into smallholders. And that cuts against the grain of the laissez-faire that, the orthodox political economy upholds at the time, and prompts Wakefield to weave the series of myths like Locke and Burke before him to cast the continuing dispossession of the British emigrants in a kind of liberal mold of a contractual language, of a myth of contractual dispossession. So in other words, to sort of sum up the three flashpoints or episodes of liberalism's encounter with, or if you will, emergence through, which are the same thing, the history of capitalism. We have colonial land appropriation as a problem of private property in the 17th century, and Locke's concern is to uphold private property against the depredations of monarchical prerogative in England while authorizing the same kind of prerogative in America. In the 18th century, we have the problem of incorporating Indian Ocean into British commercial capitalism, but through very non-commercial, if you will, extortion and militaristic terms, and how to square that circle. And finally, in the 19th century, we have the fervor of abolitionism and the ideal of free labor, but at the same time, the need to maintain wage labor, dispossessed wage labor in Britain's colonies to replace, if you will, slave labor in the Caribbean and in settler colonies, establish capitalist agriculture, and how to square that with the ideology of free labor. So that's kind of the configuration of liberalism, capitalism, and empire in the three episodes that I investigate.
And this is, again, the sort of structure of the book that you go through. After an introduction and a sort of an overview, you go through each individual writer, Locke, Burke, and Wakefield, and these critical moments with the triad of property exchange and labor as the kind of areas that you explore and analyze. So now, if you're going to let me, I'm going to ask you about Human Smith, because I think this is the right time.
Okay, sure. So Human Smith, to step back, take a step back. Of the three figures that I examine in the book, Burke is the most controversial in the sense that people have debated whether Burke was an imperialist or a critic of empire, or was a defender of empire or the critic of empire. And in that debate, Smith and Hume make cameo appearances, and they appear even more unadulterated critics of empire. And, you know, when you look at his writings, you do find plenty of evidence that can be mustered to that interpretation. They both advocated, you know, they both wrote both and openly in their writings and in their correspondence that they would wish to see these empires dissolve, that they are sort of follies, that sort of monuments to unreason, as Emma Rothschild put it, and so on and so forth. So, you know, they're basically the stalwarts of the Enlightenment against empire, you know, to take a shortcut and to use a phrase that Sankar Muthu has coined. And what I do in the second project is to focus on the writings of Hume Smith and I'm currently working to try to navigate my way through some utilitarian sort of colonial reform movement for sort of further iterations of this. I'll get to that in a second. To triangulate the same ideological institutional problem from the other end, from the other side of the normative divide. Again, this book, the second book, is not about Hume Smith or Bentham or James Mill, but it's again about the constitutive and contradictory relationship between liberalism, capitalism, and empire. Now, the thrust of the current project is to show the limits of an anti-imperial critique that is mounted from the standpoint of a liberal conception of commerce and capital. That is, positing commerce and capital and their cosmopolitan promise of peace and prosperity as an alternative to, or an antithesis of, empire, of mercantilism, of the colonial system. And what I do in, again, situating the writings of these figures in an imperial context that is reconstructed through the categories of critical political economy, is to show to discover or identify those moments where this critique reaches its limit, that where they have these figures had to fall silent or had to equivocate or had to soft pedal certain discussions. And I do this through a discussion of Hume on colonial slavery, for instance. And this is an article version of this has come out in History of Political Thought earlier this year, last year. Why, for instance, Hume speaks rather volubly and in length about slavery as an institution in the Greco-Roman world, in feudal Europe, and Asiatic despotism, but almost says nothing about Atlantic colonial slavery, notwithstanding the fact that he was an apprentice. I mean, he worked at the Bristol merchant's house, and he had acquaintances, friends who were very active in the Atlantic circuits of slave trade and plantation. Export-oriented plantation, agriculture, and so on. And the thesis there is that, well, you know, if you dig too deep, you realize that the commerce that is posited as the alternative to empire is itself constituted by empire. So there's this kind of constitutive relationship between empire and commerce that functions as a break, if you will, or a limit to anti-imperial critique that hangs his hat on a liberal conception of commerce. A similar dynamic I observe in Adam Smith's discussion of settler colonialism. So Smith is firebrand when it comes to slavery, when it comes to militarized trading. So his criticism of the East India Company or the British slavers or the planters or plantocracy is nothing short of scathing. Yet when you look at his treatment of settler colonies, you see a much more ambivalent, to use a popular term, ambivalent attitude. And I don't think that's really ambivalent. I'll get that in a second again. Much more positive attitude, notwithstanding some of the misgivings of the initial conquest and so on and so forth. As I said, a much more positive attitude towards settler colonialism. And I argue that that has to do with the fact that he models his theory of the natural progress of opulence, which is the backbone of his analysis of both the four stages theory and the stage of his analysis of the commercial stage on the settler capitalist formation of the Atlantic colonies, of the North Atlantic British colonies in particular. But of course, that implicates the model of natural progress of opulence in territorial conquest and native dispossession. And when you take a close look at Smith's discussion of these origins of settler colonies, you have invocations of peaceful Greek precedents, if you will, in the image of which he imagines or envisions settler colonies. So in other words, in both cases, I take these limits, these equivocations, these silences, elisions, or disavowals, not as intentional prevarications or bad faith, really, but as inscriptions or expressions of a broader institutional ideological contradiction. So it's not an ambivalence of an individual thinker and due to his moral commitments, but rather a broader historical structural, if you will, contradiction that finds expression in these figures who, earnestly, really, grapple with empire, its violence, and denounce it as unjust and economically destructive and so on and so forth. But again, there's an inhabiting, if you will, for the lack of a better term, and then I'm going to draw flak for this, I know, it's a bourgeois ideology. And then these ambivalences, the so-called ambivalences of individual thinkers, I deem to be expressions of a bourgeois critique of capitalist unevenness that cannot recognize the constitutive violence of primitive accumulation as belonging to capital. The liberal, because it conceives of capital as an essentially liberal the social formation, and therefore when it is confronted by slavery, by militarized trading, by territorial conquest, it can at best consign these violent transformations to the prehistory of capital, after which, life, liberty, property, and Bentham, as Marx sardonically put it, reigns supreme, but does not include these violent transformations in a theory of capital. And that is something that is also present in contemporary economic history that accounts for the histories of colonialism, but nonetheless cannot admit it into a theory of capitalism. So for Smith, for instance, and then this is a sort of splendid expression of this, Smith discusses colonial slavery openly and excoriates it openly, but he explains slavery on psychological and moral grounds and not on economic grounds, that it's the love of domineering and tyrannizing. So in other words, classical political economy as elaborated by Smith cannot admit slavery as a category of political economy. That is the language in which commerce and capital is expressed.
So the critique of it is one that is not based in the economic problematic that it presents.
That is right, in a sense. So the economy is constituted by political and legal power, so juridical political force. Like there's the laws of capitalism are not just a movement of the profits, rents, and wages, but actually laws of capitalism. So labor laws, property laws, these are the constitution, if you will, in the political sense of the term, constitution of the economic, but they cannot be accounted from within the language of economics. And so because they are, in a sense, the constitutive of, so in other words, This is something that I delved into in a recent article, that this is really not in the book, the theoretical stakes of the theoretical threads of the book that I've been exploring in a number of articles. And this one, the latest one, came out in Political Theory. So primitive accumulation is akin to constituent power in democratic theory or constitutional theory, in the sense that it brings into existence an order, a social order, not just a legal, but a socio-legal order, that cannot account for this constitutive force or constitutive moment by the norms and the practices that are internal to this constituted order itself. So in that sense, the empire and the violence of empire, to the extent that it is constitutive of global commerce and capital, remains in a sense the constitutive outside of classical political economy, that it gives rise to the institutional forms and social practices around which liberal ideas about contract, contractual freedom, juridical equality, life, liberty, property, and so on and so forth can emerge, coagulate, and solidify. But these ideas themselves, or these norms themselves, cannot account for the historical violence, the constitutive or constituent of violence or force or Gewalt, as you know, the German capacious term, that gives rise to their conditions of possibility. And it is that which I'm tracing in the liberal critics of empire. So in other words, what the two books try to accomplish together is to show that by looking at this problem from both sides of the normative divide, we can discern that there is an ideological problem that is, for the lack of a better term, objective or structural or independent of the individual moral commitments or sensibilities of the thinkers under study. That the fact that both the liberal defenders and the liberal critics of empire hit this limit or had to grapple with this, the problem of the illiberalism of capitalism or the violence of colonial capitalism suggests that there was a problem that cannot be derived from or reduced to the texts of political theory, political economy under study, but requires imperial the contextualization of these texts, of these ideas in a theory of the imperial context that is social, and a social theory of the imperial context. That is, we have to compound intellectual history, if you will. And again, this is where I draw flak from intellectual historians of linguistic contextualist bent. We have to compound intellectual history, as important context is, with a theory of the imperial context that is social in nature. And that is what I mean by the aspiration of the two books together to contribute towards a new social history of political thought that is imperial in scope. And by social history of political thought, of course, I'm referring to a strand of interpretation that was very controversially inaugurated by C.B. McPherson and then expanded by Ellen Mason's Wood, Neil Wood, and David McNally, and has fallen out of favor after the broadsides that they have received volley after volley from linguistic contextualist school, you know, the so-called Cambridge School. And notwithstanding, you know, the insights of that school, and notwithstanding the fact that I work very closely with Cambridge School or linguistic contextualist studies, I do have the ambition, if you will, to bring the social back in, so to speak, but this time not in the narrowly English, British, or even European scope, and that is what the social history of political thought has done. They've always focused on English capitalism, English working class, English enclosures, and so on and so forth, but widen the scope to the colonial and global constitution of the social, so to speak, in which to situate political ideas.
So the second project or the second book, which they are essentially in dialogue with one another, obviously, is the second book completed? And if so, when's it coming out?
So no, it's not completed. Okay. It's in progress. I have by and large finished the drafts of the Hume and slavery and Smith and settler colonialism chapters, and the second book also mirrors the structure of the first book in the sense that, again, labor, property, and exchange are at the center. They're the three hinges that connect anti-imperial critique to the histories of to the history of capitalism or colonial capitalism. Hence, human colonial slavery focuses on labor. Smith and settler colonialism focuses on property. And as a third chapter, I'm not entirely sure, as I said, I'm still wading through the utilitarian takes on empire, because, you know, Bentham and James Mill and their followers in the colonial reform movement have been critical of the old colonial system, so to speak, the mercantilist system, on the grounds that it was completely economically sterile, if not destructive, that it was kind of an outdoor relief for unproductive aristocracies, and that the so-called trade, the jealousy of trade, was pointless because it was, you know, Ricardo's theory of accumulation, and told them that capital created trade, but not the other way around. And I'm looking at the limits of that argument, that we don't need trade and therefore we don't need empire to expand our trade. Limits of that argument with the begrudging admission that, yes, there was overproduction or overaccumulation in Britain in the early 19th century, and settler colonies and a reform of the Indian economy is necessary to overcome that bottleneck, that problem. So that's going to be the third chapter. That's going to be the trade chapter, or the market exchange chapter. And the focus will be on mainly on India. And let me just conclude with, I mean, that description with something that I found in Thomas Bovington Macaulay's parliamentary speeches. And this was just a moment of revelation, really. And that's really how I work. I just find something that strikes me and then just follow it down the rabbit hole. The hat and turban debate in India, that whether there should be direct rule. This is the debate between Orientalists and the Anglicists, whether there should be direct British rule in India, British institutions, British language, British laws, or whether there should be indirect rule, that the British should rule through local customs, local laws, and institutions. In other words, whether the hat or the turban should rule. And Macaulay says, well, who cares if it's the hat or the turban that rules, if the turban is made of British muslin? So this is, you know, this writing in the 1830s. This is the period of glut and crisis of overaccumulation in Britain. So it's the political economy and a particular political economy of capitalist crisis in Britain that I find reflected or captured by a pronouncement on how to turn India into a society of consumers from a society of producers. And of course, that links up with the abolitionist debates that, you know, slave societies are actually societies of producers, not of consumers, because slaves cannot consume. Right. They don't have any income. And likewise, India, we've been bleeding India dry. We've been extorting. We've been draining Indian wealth. And of course, doing that undermines any capacity on the part of this vast continent to buy English goods. And what we want is markets. And therefore, we have to institute reforms to transform India from a society of producers into a society of consumers. But that requires pretty heavy legal and administrative reform and intervention in the Indian social fabric. So anyways, that's kind of the dimension of the direction of the third node or episode of this study. I waxed a little bit longer on this one because the first two episodes are written, and the third one is the one that I'm thinking more systematically and out loud nowadays.
So you're in the midst of it, as it were.
Yeah.
So thank you for talking to me about not only colonial capitalism and the dilemmas of liberalism, but also the next book. Does it have a working title?
It does. It's called Between Commerce and Empire. Capitalism and the Limits of Anti-Imperial Critique.
Sounds great. Will you come back on the New Books in Political Science podcast and talk about it once it comes out?
I would love
great. To. Great. Thank you so much for being with me today, Ulash.
Well, thank you for the opportunity, Lily. I appreciate it.
I really recommend Colonial Capitalism and the Dilemmas of Liberalism by Ulash Inje. Which was published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. And I'm sure it can be picked up at all the usual places, as well as I'm sure at the Oxford University Press website. Any place else that you might suggest somebody pick up your book, Ulash?
Your local bookshop, just place an order. Support local business.
Exactly. Thank you again for talking to me all the way from halfway around the world in Singapore.
For the time difference. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And we will talk again.
Great. See you soon.